Freifahrt.
I can't find a single mayor or high-level transportation official at city level who thinks electric cars are a particularly large part of his or her portfolio right now. Whereas bicycles are public transport, and walking, and health, and space for recreation, and pedestrianised city centres for a better quality of life and a better retail experience is what's on people's minds.
Willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Freifahrt, dem Interview-Podcast für eine neue und zukunftsfähige Mobilitätskultur. Mein Name ist Sebastian Hofer und hier frage ich mich und meine GesprächspartnerInnen sinnbildlich jede Woche wieder, weshalb es in Holland und Dänemark eigentlich selbstverständlich ist, mit einem Lastenfahrrad unterwegs zu sein und wir hierzulande immer noch kostenlosen Parkraum als Grundrecht verstehen. Mit euch zusammen möchte ich unser aktuelles Verständnis von Mobilität überwinden und an der Zukunft unserer Fortbewegung basteln, von Mikromobilität bis zum Hyperloop. Und deshalb spreche ich mit allerlei klugen Köpfen, die uns auf neue Gedanken und Wege bringen wollen. Moin und schön, dass du wieder eingeschaltet hast. Denn mein heutiger Gast ist Kevin Main. Er ist CEO von Cycling Industries Europe, also der europäischen Vereinigung und Lobbyorganisation der Fahrradbranche. Nachdem ich letzte Woche mit Isabel Eberlein von Changing Cities vor allem über den Aktivismus und die Fahrradkultur in Deutschland gesprochen habe, wollte ich von Kevin vor allem eines wissen. Wie kann es sein, dass vor allem Paris und London gerade mit unglaublichem finanziellen und politischen Engagement Fahrradmobilität fördern und Deutschland bis auf wenige Ausnahmen in Berlin und München diese historische Gelegenheit für einen wirklichen Wandel verschläft? Oder ignoriert? Wir sprechen also über seine europäische Perspektive auf die Entwicklung der Fahrradbranche in den letzten Jahren und natürlich darüber, welchen katalytischen Effekt Corona auf die Fahrradmobilität derzeit hat. Kevin sieht sich als Transformator und sagt, dass es ihn mit Stolz erfüllt, wenn er etwas bewegen kann. Bewegt hat er übrigens mit seinem Team in den letzten Wochen etwas ziemlich Großes, nämlich dass Urban Mobility und vor allem Fahrradmobilität in dem heute verkündeten sogenannten Next Generation EU Konjunkturprogramm überhaupt erstmal gefördert werden. Er sagt, es sei das erste Mal gewesen, dass sie praktisch auf Augenhöhe mit den Lobbyisten der Automobilindustrie gehört wurden, wenngleich auch leider nicht auf demselben finanziellen Level. Insgesamt hat das Paket ja eine Höhe von unglaublichen 2,4 Billionen Euro. Wie viel genau davon verwendet werden für besagte Urban Mobility und Fahrradmobilität, steht zum Stand der Aufnahme noch nicht fest. Gefordert haben sie doch ein Gesamtpaket für Infrastruktur und Kaufprämien für Fahrräder in Höhe von 1,5 Milliarden Euro und sind damit auch nicht allein. Denn eine Studie des BMU selbst fordert ein Budget für Kaufprämien für Lastenräder in Höhe von einer weiteren Milliarde Euro. Doch bevor es losgeht, möchte ich noch kurz Lobbyarbeit für meinen Beitrag zur Verkehrswende machen. Denn wenn dir der Podcast gefällt und du regelmäßig zuhörst, dann kannst du mich bei der Produktion entweder einmalig per PayPal oder auch regelmäßig auf Steady mit einem kleinen Beitrag unterstützen. Alle Links dazu findest du in den Shownotes und ich sage vielen, vielen Dank. Und jetzt wünsche ich euch viel Spaß und neue Erkenntnisse mit Kevin Main von Cycling Industries Europe. Kevin, I would like to start with a quote by Matthew Baldwin, the Deputy Director General at the EU for Road Safety and Sustainable Mobility. He said, don't waste this awful crisis. Put down traffic bollards. Get out the paint pots. If you get the bike lanes out there, people will use them. Perfection can follow. If we don't, we will wake up one morning, we will draw back the curtains and find that the old normal is back. So I'd like to start with the first question after saying a warm welcome. What does this quote tell you about the perception of cycling during COVID-19, Kevin?
Hi, it's good to be here and thanks for the invitation. Yeah, it's a really interesting time to talk about cycling. And from my own perspective, I work for Cycling Industries Europe, which is a trade body. And we've started with the kind of, I mean, there was a kind of rumor of a problem in the supply chain in China. I mean, that's where this started. I remember that conversation in February where people were saying, keep your ears open. This sounds like there's something here. And, you know, and we've been through almost kind of desperation and businesses closing and guiding people through some really, really tough times where, you know, a proportion of our members were saying we might not make it as a business. And now we seem to be sitting on the crest of a kind of cycling wave. And the question might be, have we got enough bikes? So, I mean, when Matthew says, don't waste a crisis, I think it's been a, a business crisis, but then in a lobby and advocacy terms, it's actually been the opportunity he describes. And I was doing speeches in all the way through this process. And I remember towards the end of March, I was kind of saying there's two things going on here. In the business community, we've just got to hang on in there and survive this. But to our government friends and our advocates and our communities, people are on the streets. The message is they like it. The message is cycling is essential for the first time. We're really getting that story across. Bike shops are essential. Bike share is essential. And space is essential. And actually, they love it. And so then the onus is on the cities to say, well, why would you open all the streets? Why not hold some back? And we heard, I think, probably Berlin broke the mold first. And then fairly quickly, Paris was very bold. Bogota.
Very bold, yes.
You know, and that set, certainly Paris set a lovely benchmark where you could actually, when I did it, I just multiplied the street distance up and said, that's 95,000 kilometers in the EU if everybody did what Paris does. And that gives us getting cities into competition and getting mayors and transport officials to be bolder. So I'm really pleased with that kind of catalytic effect and the boldness.
For you as a cyclist, I can imagine that the last weeks must have been a paradise for you living outside of Brussels, and especially now that Brussels pretty much closed down the center for cars. So how do you experience all this personally, Kevin?
Well, it's been an odd one because I'm in my daily life a combined public transport and cycling user. And my kind of abiding memory of my last days in the office is going further and further and further by bike because I was deeply unhappy being on the public transport. And I suspect that I am not alone. Because that is one of the kind of absolutely key messages, that when I'm on my bike, I feel great. And I have to say, from a mental health and physical health point of view, this has been an amazing time. I go for a beautiful ride in the countryside in the morning. I call it my ride to work. It is therapeutic. And the prospect of going back onto crowded trains fills me with dread. And fills my family with dread. The cycling is the most positive and powerful thing I do in my day. The public transport is not.
I have to say, it worries me a little bit that you, as an advocate and expert in the field, also think about public transport and crowded trains as a dreadful idea and nothing really that you're looking forward to. Although I absolutely understand it, obviously. But did you ever think about why you didn't do the morning commute on your bike mainly before COVID?
Simply distance. I mean, it's 20. You know, it's an hour and a half. So if I'm a fitness cyclist, which I am, and I have grown up in kind of sporty cycling, you know, I like to be fit, and on Sundays I ride with a club and this kind of stuff. So but it's training. You know, it requires a shower. I mean. But what was exciting before all this came about was that this is a journey I've made for, you know, eight years now. And that's a journey where two or three days a week I would cycle in, shower, change, whatever else. But I was always alone. It was me and the wildlife until I reached the boundaries of Brussels. And suddenly in the last 2 years, these mysterious creatures have appeared kind of alongside me. And it's like other cyclists. And I'm like, wow. And then there's that distinctive whirring noise where you go, aha, e-bike. And from where I travel from, which is outside the kind of Brussels suburbia, the e-bikes have arrived en masse. And it, you know, I don't know what the factor is from 1 to 10 to 20 to 30 people on this corridor leading into Brussels. But if you imagine that as a multiplier across the whole of Europe, it shows the extraordinary effect of the arrival of the e-bike because it's making 10 or 15 kilometer commutes normal.
I'm wondering if we could say, from a very pragmatic and optimistic perspective, maybe, that this corona crisis sort of came at a good timing. I mean, there are e-bikes available now, and the fact that the other crisis, the climate crisis, had an impact on people's mindsets and openness towards cycling as a more, yeah, more sustainable and healthy way to commute. Is this actually the change we needed?
Yeah, but I think the difference is, you know, a really catalytic change, a really, you know, a disruptive change is caused by potentially a new product, but also a change of study. Because commuting behavior is a very strange thing. It's deeply entrenched. And I always tell people, don't forget, this is the trip most people do not want to make. So don't kid them, you're going to make it better. You know, we may have taken up cycling, and we know no cyclists have mental health. But if you're struggling to get the kids out the door, struggling to imagine congestion, struggling to think what's on your agenda when you arrive in a busy office, and some hippie comes along and says you should do this by bike, the mental barriers are just too strong. So we know behavior change of job, change of lifestyle, moving house, you need a disruptive bump. And I think this is why COVID is going to be very, very special and very motivational, because the alternatives look much worse.
But you would assume that the alternative would mean everybody going back into their cars. But in fact, we see an uprise of cycling.
No, I mean, as an environmentalist, cannibalizing cycling and public transport is not the best answer. But it's even worse if people leave public transport for cars. And that's what city mayors are fearing. This is this kind of nightmare of the moment. But even at a personal leisure point of view, you know, you can't go to the gym. You can't go on holiday this year. I mean, I was listening to a broadcast Belgian radio at the weekend. They're interviewing a bike shop owner. And he says, no, people are coming in buying bikes to go to work. But they're also already buying their bikes for the summer holiday because they don't think they'll be able to leave Belgium. And so a bicycle is associated with kind of domestic holiday and a certain disruptive change in their lifestyle. We all like to believe that would have happened anyway over time with progressive growth in cycling and more e-bikes, this kind of, but this is potentially a huge acceleration, and that's really important.
Kevin, you're now the CEO of the Cycling Industry Europe, a new association for corporate advocacy at the EU level. It's you founded this as one of your roles for working for the European Cycling Federation, where you started 2012, as far as I know. And you've been in the cycling advocacy and governance for over 20 years. You have lots of experience and stories to tell, which I would like to hear, obviously, but we probably don't have the time. But maybe start off with one question. Do you remember when you had the epiphany that cycling is apparently something which doesn't only make sense, but it's healthier, it's better for the environment, maybe it's more fun, maybe it's the reason that you consume less space. Do you remember the moment where you realized you want to be one of those hippies that you mentioned, changing the world from a cyclist perspective?
I guess I'm a slightly odd case in that I grew up with this. So what I actually did was got the chance to get my dream job. I grew up in a family that cycled in a small country town in the east of England, which was one of the regions where cycling hung on as a mode of transport much longer than other areas. Rural, less affluent. And you know, there was never a time where we didn't ride our bikes to school. I delivered newspapers on my bicycle as a kid and so on and so forth. But quite oddly, my parents were also racing cyclists, both my mother and my father. And so cycling and the cycling club and the cycling community was part of my DNA right through that period. I ran the university cycling club when I was a 20-year-old. I was kind of, you know, chairman of the cycling club. So I've been in and around it. And one of the things I discovered, you know, as you do with all these things, I'm not very good at cycle racing. I'm just not very good. I enjoy it enormously. I quite enjoy getting fit and being healthy. And I've tried almost everything, mountain biking and all sorts of stuff like that. And so touring and traveling by bike is just embedded. But one of the things I discovered when I was 16, 17 years old was I was much better at organizing the races and, selling the Mars bars in the club room than I was at actually winning the races. And so being an organizer and being active in that world was something I did through university years, then went off and did a corporate career. And then I got this amazing opportunity to sort of where the CEO's job came up at the British Cyclists Association, which the German audience will know was the kind of RDFSA equivalent. It's now called Cycling UK. But they wanted a CEO with a very different background who felt the kind of DNA of cycling, but could bring the kind of corporate experience and package. So there's just this extraordinary moment where I got a sort of business training in management and combined it with my youth, where my parents were both cyclists and political activists in our life. So put that together, and it's a kind of marriage made in heaven.
And it's interesting that you call yourself an odd case, because it reminds me of my interview with Christian Brink from Urban Sharing, because as far as I know, you studied physics and he studied archaeology, and you both ended up in the cycling industry and doing lots of great work to promote, and in your case, to advocate for a stronger cycling, cycling culture. Would you say that this different perspective helps you to help others look at this from a different perspective?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I describe myself. I mean, I represent the professional sector, but even in my business career, I would have said, I was professional, but I was a change agent. I was someone companies used me in a change agent role and a strategic role, and they trained me and gave me a skill set. And it gives me enormous kind of pride and a sense of achievement when you feel something move. You feel a change where you kind of, you're like the butterfly flaps its wings and somewhere else there's a kind of a storm. And particularly at the European level, I mean, that's what we do. It's a kind of remote kind of politics with the European layer. But you've got to think that this means potentially billions of euros that appear in budgets down in regional level, down in city budgets, or there's a small company somewhere that's a startup that's got a great idea or a great technology, and it's something you've done that makes, they put cycling in the application form and people react positively. And so, that ultimately that's what I do. And that's where, I almost call it, funding is my football. It's when I win the race. It's a strange thing, but you see money flow and you think, I helped get that money to the people where they can spend it. And it's a very visible symbol, obviously, along with a policy change or a regulation change that you get through.
When you say that you like seeing movement happen, then what is happening currently due to COVID-19 must look like a great opportunity for you, I imagine. So how do you, and how does the cycling industry react to this crisis right now?
Well, I think I alluded to it. Yeah, I mean, there was a sort of, it was recession mindset, and then it was, I think what we call it, there's reopening and there's recovery. They're the kind of three phases. And I think the reopening phase is what's most interesting, because it comes back. I described my kind of personal relationship with public transport during this time, but that's a societal reaction. And that's a crisis for that sector, but it's a crisis for any government that wants to reopen, because you've got to get the people to the places you believe. Maybe working at home solves part of the problem, but there's an element in all societies. We know we're a social species, and workplaces and others are not just about the actions, they're about the social integration. And so we need to get people to those places. And what we've done, I think, really, really well is place the bicycle as the kind of efficient buffer. This is where you can find a million trips a day. or a million trips a week.
Who do you mean by we? You said we placed the bike as the buffer.
Well, I think the lobby movement and, you know, the kind of undercurrent, and actually the cycling movement itself was able to kind of paint this picture. Cycling is an essential service. Well, people like I, myself, same thing, you know, it's giving people the words. And what we're doing at the moment is giving people the words. And I'm just, for example, in a completely parallel way, I'm doing some work with the mountain biking community. And they're lagging some long way behind the urban environment because maybe the countryside is not so open and, you know, hotspots for tourism are not open. But we're giving activists the language. We might give city mayors the language. We might give people, you know, wherever we can through media, social media, through training, through guidance. And particularly the reopening phase, it's giving that picture that cycling can be a buffer. And if the buffer is 10% of public transport capacity or 20% or 30%, now is the time where we can step into that space. And on top of that, we have the opportunity then to look at, you know, it's the physical environment. It's the so-called COVID lanes. Behind that, you've then got to give people bikes. And this should not be an exclusively kind of middle class, middle income, protected income way of moving. So it may be we need funding. It may be we need bike share. It may be various kinds of support programs to make sure, you know, if you live in an apartment block where there's nowhere to park bikes, maybe it's secure parking. But we've got to make sure people can actually get bikes. And I think there is an equality issue around that as well. And at a European level, this cannot be solely a kind of rich Northwest European recovery. I really want to see more bikes and e-bikes in South and Eastern Europe as a result. And that's a tougher ask because there's an economic differential.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is something that you can also see from, if you look at the European map now, and if we look at all the countries and cities which are in the news with their Corona bike lanes, with their plans to change the traffic infrastructure, it's mostly Italy, France, and the UK nowadays. And this fascinates me because I wouldn't have thought that these countries would be the ones that actually might overtake countries like Germany, maybe, or even the Netherlands in terms of cycling infrastructure. But if you look at the pure numbers, in Paris, they're talking about 650 kilometers of cycling infrastructure. That would mean it's like 72% of its on-street car parking will be closed for velo routes. Or even Milan, it's 35 kilometers of cycle lanes, and they're handing out 50 euros for everybody or all the, every resident of cities with more than 50,000 inhabitants. There are £250 million ready for bike lanes in the UK, and in London, they're talking about a bike tube network compared to the regular tube network. So obviously, this is a huge and historic change for cycling mobility, for cycling culture. And I would really like to hear your opinion and your perspective on this. If the UK and France will be the countries that we will talk about as the most innovative and cycling-friendly countries in the next maybe 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I think it's a big, big conclusion that they might overtake some of the leaders. A lot of the countries we're talking about, I mean, it's extraordinarily exciting. Let's not knock it first, you know, and maybe it's tougher, you know, when your cycling mode share is 2%, the idea of handing over a whole bunch of streets to the cyclists is a tougher political call than if you're at 10 or 20, 30% and you've got to the tipping point where this is already maybe normal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, it's so exciting. You know, it's exciting for me to be British, but it's exciting if you're in Paris, or it's exciting in, you know, some of the cities, because it's the big chance to kind of catch up. But, you know, if you assume that, I think it was, say, Berlin had a kind of mode share of 13%, you know, do I believe that London will be at 13% as a result of these measures? No. I mean, it's starting from 2%. There'll be some very, very visible corridors that are exciting, and some of the boroughs will do things. And it would be exciting to see a trajectory rapidly. We know from some of the Spanish cities, it's possible to go very fast to 6, 7, 8%. And so, you know, we hopefully there's just this wave of confidence where in the challenging cities, I mean, I think an interesting case is Dublin. Dublin hosted Velo City last year. They were heavily criticized by delegates because they never finished their strategic cycling network. So delegates from all over the world were visiting a city that said it was cycle friendly, and they were stuck on an incomplete, poorly developed network. And now suddenly they're completing that network. And so there's a political unlocking that has happened.
But I think that is one of the, sorry to interrupt, but I think this is one of the major differences if you compare the mode share in Berlin to the one in London. Obviously, it's not going to quadruple in no time, but it is a different political situation in the first place. What's happened in Germany and maybe the Netherlands was something that started in the 1780s in the Netherlands. And there wasn't anything like this where everybody's talking about physical distancing as a requirement for surviving.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, we have a visibility at a European level of trajectories in different countries, or perhaps more importantly, different cities. Because it's quite interesting, even some of the low cycling countries we'll have flagship cities with mode shares of 20%. You know, Italy's had Ferrara. It's a smaller city, but you could see real ambition, you know, real progress there. You could see other cities where things, you know, could see Bologna, the figures are quite high, or others. And, you know, whether you went to France, you could see progress in certain cities. You know, you'd say Lyon was doing much better, Nantes was doing well, and Paris was lagging behind. But you could follow individual kind of policy interventions over a few years. And I think we, you know, for one of the most interesting was kind of Munich, you know, which under Hedmonad Zeder first off, you know, starting in 2005, 2006, and just grinding its way upwards, not to be a kind of megastar, but ending up at 16% mode share or something, just consistently delivering incremental improvements year on year on year. So in our kind of European league table, we will have cities that have fought their way up. You know, okay, very few places can be a Groningen or a Utrecht with their kind of 60%, 50%, because they've been at it for 40 years. But you can see that systemic change is possible. The pain for activists and anybody in the sector is it's grindingly slow unless you have a bold interjection of political capital, or you have a kind of crisis to react to. And so we can see cities like Seville and Vitoria and to some extent Brussels or whatever, where the intervention has been bold. I mean, Brussels has gone from 0.6% to about 6, you know, so it's desperate when I first started going there. So you can see that change. Now, this is a chance maybe to bump that right up. But what's interesting if you do this on social media, of course, what you see is the excitement of activists. You see a bias towards certain languages, particularly English. And so you get a very mixed in, you know, and it is harder to celebrate that kind of incremental Munich kind of thing in a world of social media. Yeah, and someone has to have the graphs and has to tell the story and has to build it up. You know, and even London, I mean, the early London growth from 1990s onwards was really kind of incremental, but you'd see, say, central London doubling and doubling and doubling and dragging up, not bringing suburbia with it, but suddenly reaching a point where a lot of journalists would notice, wow, there's a lot of cyclists. So, I mean, there are a lot of unconscious biases in our understanding of how this works, but, you know, overall, you can't take away from the sort of Dutch and Danish success. And my feeling, and what I often talk about, is that because not all the countries have done it the same way, and not even our first tier cities have done it quite the same way, you've got to look for common threads. And my feeling is the common thread is not purely infrastructure. It is actually rebalancing the relationship between cycling and cars. And that rebalancing is most visible when it's infrastructure. But it's very interesting to go to a city, I don't know, like somewhere like Leipzig or somewhere, where you can see quite good levels of cycling, not so much infrastructure, but look, they've got a car-free city centre. So the destination is so much better. And the best way to get there, just kind of common sense, is to arrive by bicycle.
And how do you like the measures from Brussels now reducing the speed to 20 kph in the city of the city center? Is that something similar to you?
As soon as if that is enforceable, and also if it acts as a traffic deterrent, then the feedback we're hearing already, but that's during a quieter kind of COVID period, is people were loving it. They were saying, "Wow, this just feels different." And obviously having a huge and large pedestrian area means, again, through traffic, it's no longer interesting to drive through Brussels. In fact, it's no longer physically possible. And that's what Groningen particularly piloted, was this idea of that it's just the shortest trips should be by foot and by bike. And if you wish to genuinely drive in our city, you're going to go the long way around. And it can be removal of car parking. The Dutch, interestingly, the Danish, it's very noticeable, for example, that the Dutch will happily blend cars and cyclists in controlled situations. They have the Fietsstraat. Most Dutch city centres, the bike lanes take you into the city, and in many cases, then it's some kind of sharing space, perhaps shared with pedestrians, perhaps suggested which is shared with cars. The Danish system is much more regimented. They really dislike sharing. You see very little combined cycling walking. And I'm told by over the years that one of the major drivers for that is the Danish police, who effectively said, we won't enforce shared space. We like it. We like rules. We like it clear. And that's that's lazy. But it means that, for example, the Fietsstraat is not legal in Denmark. And yet you would imagine two countries so similar in cycling levels and over the same period would develop common approach to infrastructure. Actually, they don't. You can rebalance by speed. I, for a long time, thought Germany was a kind of bit of a cycling paradise compared to Britain. And that wasn't because the infrastructure was so different. That was simply because German drivers tended to obey the speed limit in the city. And that was unheard of in Britain. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And so it could be 50 kilometer an hour zone, but cars will be doing 60, 70. If you put 30 kilometer an hour zones in, the British police just said, we won't enforce it. People can do what they like. And it just never happened. Whereas I always felt there was a degree of kind of discipline. And it may be a Germanic cliche, but just as someone who's traveled all over Europe, when I go into countries and particularly into cities, even if there's not much infrastructure, the key thing to me in my gut is driver behavior. Driver behavior, infrastructure, great destinations, car-free city centers. And different countries have done those things on different trajectories. But what you have to do is rebalance the relationship with the car. And unless you do that, you don't make progress.
You just mentioned the political willpower, Kevin. And in the talk before this interview, you mentioned the recovery package by the EU. Can you go into a little bit what's happening right now and why you said that this is a different time now, that you feel that you were more shoulder to shoulder with the car lobbying industry, first time in your career as a cycling lobbyist, cycling activist?
Sure. I mean, we are, as we talk today, depending on when this is kind of published, but we are sitting on the eve of the EU publishing its recovery plan and sort of recovery budgets, which are scary large amounts of cash. You know, when people start talking billions and trillions, it's beyond our comprehension. It's been fairly heavily leaked. And even in the political talks we've had, we've known that there's going to be, originally there was nothing that might call itself urban mobility or cycling or anything in that front. And we now know there is a fairly large budget for urban mobility and urban recovery. And the drafts I've seen even specifically reference cycling and cycling infrastructure, cycling and public transport. And if we've got that into that level from a kind of zero start a few weeks ago, I think we're all going to be pretty pleased. And I'm pretty proud of the work my team's done and colleagues have done in the cycling movement in Brussels to kind of get that into key places. So I think that's a, and that is a first, that in this kind of strategic document, I mean, it's, one should just count the word cycling, but count the word cycling next to a big amount of money. That'll do nicely. Downside, we suspect probably the German power, the incoming German EU presidency, other countries, car industry is going to get a large bailout. That is frustrating. It's distorting because it's reinforcing the old. I think a lot of environmental NGOs would be happy because they think electric cars will contribute on terms of emissions and CO2. Yes, it will. But there are those of us who believe there's an even better way. And the EU hasn't yet fully embraced the concept of mode transfer between modes. They operate in vertical silos by industries. But we're beginning to position cycling and urban mobility as strategic pillars. And I think the fact we are, we hope tomorrow, explicitly in the kind of recovery plan is a huge step forward. And, you know, it is about, sadly, playing, if you like, the lobby game, which many people look down on. The car industry employs lobbyists, but frankly, the bike sector has needed to employ professional lobbyists, people whose job is to get strategic access to politicians. It is to bring every power of the argument we can possibly bring to the table. And I think we are doing that as well now as a group and as certain individuals than we've probably ever done.
I think it's fascinating that this is happening, and I would really like to learn a little bit about how this is working. Can you explain a little bit how your job as a lobbyist works and why it changed over the years and why it's been successful now?
It's interesting because one of the things I have done for a long time is coach lobbying, and that, you know, I'm not, you know, I have a bachelor's in physics and I have a business career. But as I said, what I've been more than anything else is a change person. So it's kind of studying, if you like, political science and actually understanding how one does change. And it's pretty rare. I mean, you will have public movements that swing political sympathies and people vote and, you know, whether it's the rise of populism, da, da, da. But there's a sort of crunch set of skills that practiced lobbying has to have. And, you know, it's always harder to lobby if the product's rubbish. You know, our case, the product is, you know, the actual act of cycling has so many and multiple benefits that you should package and place them well. And that means also then placing them credibly. So if I go out and say there's 600,000 jobs in cycling in Europe, that has to be credible. I need a university to have validated that, and I need to have done my work properly with others, with European Cyclists Federation or national level with the RDFCs and others. You do your work properly. You package that. Secondly, you know, you need to build coalitions. And I think I'm very lucky. I mean, when I started Cycling Industries Europe last year, I mean, collectively, the first three employees have got nearly 60 years of experience in lobbying and advocacy. My two colleagues have done that a lot in Brussels and in different fields like energy and consumer affairs. And that means, you know, a network, doors that can be opened, a certain confidence with the briefs. And the fact that people of that quality want to work in cycling is very exciting. You know, they consciously look at what we're doing and go, wow, I'd love to work in that sector. And then, you know, thirdly, there is this sense of you have to pitch the right product. So, you know, in 2013, when it was all about recession and jobs, we were creating political narratives around cycling and jobs. now we are creating political narratives around recovery and, you know, protecting public transport and, you know, building towards a European Green Deal. And we have to place that narrative professionally at the right time. And at somewhere further on, there'll be another narrative. And that will be different from country to country. And that's where it's very useful to work with the national associations of whether it's consumer or whether it's industry associations, because you, when you coach them and teach them, you've got to teach them it is all cut and paste. Yeah, you've got to take the right narrative to the right politician at the right time.
Sometimes it's easy to say that the car lobby is so relevant and so big because they constantly talk about workplace security and the contribution to the national GDPs. How relevant is the contribution to the GDP for being heard?
The key is, if you don't have it, you're not in the room. So the same would be on, say, electromobility. You know, if we didn't have the e-bikes, we would be in none of the electromobility rooms. So-called intelligent transport systems, where, you know, connected mobility and digital management of traffic flows is a huge room with a lot of money being spent on it. Might lead to automated cars, but it might lead to other things. If we are not able to describe our product and our policy objectives, then we are not in that room. And that's one of the things we do at Cycling Institute Europe, is to say, right, you know, we have some of the best people in digitalized cycling in our membership. You know, we have the bike share community who are in the kind of sharing economy and who have, again, digitalization and fantastic data. We have bike makers and parts makers. And, you know, we have a few people from infrastructure and other areas, but we have to be able to reach across. Because, yeah, if there's a high-level seminar on jobs recovery and someone looks at cycling and says, would you like to be on my podium, come and tell your job story, and you don't have a job story, you are not in the room. As it is, some of our stories are much more impressive than people realize, and particularly the economics. The car industry does that well, but interesting, they almost stopped talking about mobility. It's really quite striking.
What do you mean they stop talking about mobility?
Well, you'll find very hard to find a car lobbyist who actually describes cars as the future of mobility. Because it's not credible. It might be we'll save the planet from emissions if existing cars switch to cleaner cars. It might be we've got to protect these 12 million jobs. But car diplomacy and lobbying is increasingly less and less about mobility. Where, you know, so if you go and talk to a mobility, I mean, my example for what we might get announced from the EU is that I can't find a single mayor or high-level transportation official at city level who thinks electric cars are a particularly large part of his or her portfolio right now. They just make the congestion thing the worse. You know, they don't solve the parking space problem. They don't solve inequality. And, okay, it would be nice if they were greener, but if you tell me by the European Union I've got to give up a whole lot of street space for car charging points, it's not on the list. Whereas bicycles and public transport and walking and health and space for recreation and pedestrianised city centres for a better quality of life and a better retail experience is what's on people's minds.
It also works well on the first page of newspapers if Anne Hidalgo is on a bicycle, or even the king of Holland, Willem Alexander, rides a bicycle, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, those figures, I think the Anne Hidalgo is the, you know, as a lobbying, as an active political figure, she's kind of pivotal and has been so powerful. And people like Maria Vassalaku before her in Vienna and others that have kind of broken that ground in new countries or in capital cities where you were able to kind of make that shift. And none of those people would put electric cars at the top of their, this is what I want the European Commission to give me next week. But the more detached you are almost from the reality of where people live and move, the more susceptible maybe you are to other arguments. And, we can't take away from the fact that jobs is a big argument. You know, it's politicians live for the economics.
And also the fact that we need to distinguish between city and rural living conditions.
Yeah, rural, as you know, not to deprive people of that, but I think cities at the moment are very powerful allies of our movement. And but it's challenging if you're a city level activist. You know, it's you're shouting at your mayor saying, "Give me more bike lanes, make this particular junction safer." And you might stand back and go, "Well, you know, okay, the city is the best chance we have, because your national government might be further away and the EU might be even further away. And so, you know, what are we going to do with our cities?" And then people like me, it's our job to consolidate those city stories to say, look, this is a credible European solution. You know, we have enough first division, flagship, exciting European capital cities and large cities that are grabbing this cycling thing. Do you, the European Union, not recognize that this is a win-win in green terms, in societal terms? And so it goes back to that, you know, we've got to package up credible solutions for every level of government.
And how do you actually package up these credible solutions? I mean, how is CIE set up for this? What kind of members and resources can you bring to the table?
We are doing our work for our member companies, but increasingly that is setting the tone for the whole industry. So we run international expert groups where we've got some of the best and more kind of far-sighted companies in each sector. So we run the European Cargo, Bike and Logistics Group. We run the European Bike Share Group. We run the European Connected Cycling and Intelligent Transport Group. And we're doing other things, like we're working on an innovation and SMEs and startup group. And that's quite good, because that companies are joining us for the very practical reason they want to be in a room with their colleagues, and there's some stuff we need to get done. And I'm hoping we see different cycling sectors much more professionalized, much more connected, a much more kind of unified industry. And that's, as well as the lobbying we've talked about much of this call, that's the other thing we do. And that's very catalytic for the companies that are joining us. So I hope if there's company staff or, you know, different companies on the list, this is the first time you've heard of us, take a look, because this is an important and growing space. Hopefully we do both for you. We can be a European voice, but we can be a very, very practical resource for companies to get some stuff moving in these new and developing areas.
Which are the ones that you have in mind? Which are the ones where you need support, or where there's like a particularly strong movement nowadays?
Well, I think the fact that they exist means that the kind of bike share, cycle logistics and connected cycling groups as kind of sectors are sectors where they've done well, but they're now really recognizing the next step is about behaving like an industry group. So it's going to government, setting standards, getting involved in, there's a new standard being developed for cargo bikes, but we've just done a big survey of the marketplace to try and understand just how big this market is, so we can help people develop their business plans. We're even helping one or two companies talk to kind of angel investors and venture capitalists. So, you know, it could be real stuff that moves your company forward. What's coming, I think the one I'm working on quite hard is a market intelligence group, which is to try and understand that the bike industry is still very short of numbers compared to many sectors. And if we get this going, I think it's going to be one of the best intelligence sources we ever had as a sector, which will be commercially valuable to companies. And we are looking at the framework for regularizing that kind of investment, investor, EU funds, SMEs, entrepreneurs space, so that the really exciting smaller companies have a kind of dynamic place, because they're quite scattered across Europe now, maybe a little bit isolated. And I think there's a big opportunity for us to have a network. We ran a small competition last year to offer some funding and some pilots on the streets of Dublin. funded by Smart Dublin, and 40 companies applied at about 2 weeks' notice. So we know there's real demand, but there's also demand to form a community. So it's not all about the huge companies. It's also about where the next generation of growing companies are going to come from.
So that sounds like you are some kind of middleman between the grassroots communitarian startup world and then on the other side, the corporate industrial world of bigger players. Is that right?
The healthy system is both. I mean, we would not have the dynamic e-bike market growing right across Europe with reliable, high-quality products if there weren't the Accel groups and the Ponds and the Cycle Europes and the Bosches and Shimanos that are taking, you know, putting a lot of energy into making sure the system works wherever you are in the world. And it also doesn't work unless you've got lots of, you know, lovely, hungry startups and entrepreneurs and people that are kind of going to carry forward and challenge the bigger guys. So, you know, the term ecosystem can be a cliche, but I think in our world, the cycling system is great. And what's lovely is that actually even corporate cycling is not like other corporate worlds that I've worked in. Many people are only one or two generations away from when their father or their grandfather founded the company. You know, from a bike shop or from an individual product or something they brought on the market. And there's a hugely personal layer in cycling. And I do find the companies and, you know, CEOs and founders I work with have a very, very different view on what kind of commercial success means. And, you know, you go to some sectors, everybody wants to talk about the share price. In the bike sector, they want to talk about cycling. And that makes it a wonderful and enjoyable sector to work in because you've got that balance. It has to be an economically vibrant sector, but there are people who are excited about what we do for society and what we do for our riders.
That's a lot about intrinsic motivation in the end that it comes down, and it's something that you come across having a lot of as well.
Yeah, I'm saying at some point there, I fell into my dream job, and then I've managed to replicate that sort of dream job three times, and I'm thoroughly enjoying what I do. And, you know, at the end of the day, I am still that, you know, little boy on a bike back home in Suffolk, and there have to be lots more like me and who see the bicycle as a sort of a freedom, and it actually does things for children's freedom and equality and this kind of stuff. And so I suppose, you know, I'm an activist, I said, because I want things to move. But ultimately, I'm there because more people riding a bike is hopefully more people feel like I feel when they went out this morning and they just rode around in the countryside for an hour and they come home and feel, wow, you know, that's improved my day.
I love it. Let's use that as your last word, if that's fine. And I thank you. Thank you so much, Kevin, for the conversation and the insights into working as a cyclist, lobbyist, and activist. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Good to talk.
Vielen, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wenn dir die Folge gefallen hat, dann freue ich mich sehr über deine Unterstützung. Am einfachsten geht das, wenn du bei Spotify, bei Deezer, bei Podigy oder in deiner Podcast-App auf Abonnieren klickst und natürlich auch mit ein paar Sternchen und einem Kommentar bei Apple Podcasts. Außerdem freue ich mich, wenn du diesen Podcast fleißig weiterempfiehlst und auch gerne mal bei steadyhq.com/freifahrt vorbeischaust, um dir die Möglichkeiten anzuschauen, wie du mich finanziell unterstützen kannst. Wenn du Gästevorschläge, Fragen oder Kommentare hast, dann immer gerne her damit per Mail an podcast@freifahrt.org. Gerne auch auf LinkedIn, Instagram oder Twitter. Dort findest du mich ebenfalls unter dem Handle Freifahrt. Zum Schluss noch einmal ein großes Dankeschön an Max Bless von Audioboutique für das neue Sounddesign. So, das war's für heute. Ich freue mich, wenn du in der nächsten Folge wieder reinhörst und sage gute Fahrt und lass die Haare wehen.